me, it's not a matter of hanging on at any cost, hanging on for another 4 years at any cost. I still got to be the same person walking out that walked in.
Governor Walker says he's staying in the race. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, October 18th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention kicks off in Anchorage.
We invited more people to the conversation and recognized that listening is more productive than litigation.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting.
Governor Bill Walker said today he intends to stay in the race for governor unless something changes. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
Governor Walker talked to reporters after a debate with the other candidates for governor, Republican Mike Dunleavy and Democrat Mark Bagich. When asked if he's committed to staying in the race until the November 6th election, Walker responded.
I'm 100% committed to a process, and you know, we'll see what happens between now and now on election day. I mean, you know, I'll tell you what, it's been an interesting few months, I'll put it that way.
Democratic leaders have asked for Walker to end his campaign. It's too late to be removed from the ballot. Roughly 1,000 absentee ballots have already been returned. Walker said his message to those considering voting early is that he's still in the race and that new Lieutenant Governor Valerie Nuuraluk-Davidson would be very good at the job. He pushed back on a question about whether anyone else could become Lieutenant Governor.
It's too soon for that. I don't have any reason to think it'd be anybody other than Val Davidson. I think she's a phenomenal Alaskan, and she's eminently qualified for that position.
Dunleavy asked Bagich during the debate if he's in negotiations with the Walker camp to cut a deal for one of them to drop out. Bagich said he'd like Dunleavy to drop out. Walker added that the Republican Party asked him to be their candidate. He later clarified that Republicans spoke with someone close to him after Dunleavy filed to run last year.
Yeah, they contacted me. They wanted me to be their candidate.
Alaska Republican Party Chairman Tuckerman Babcock denied that. He said in a press release that Walker, quote, attempted a lame joke unless recent stress is causing him to lose grip on reality, end quote. Babcock says the party's only contact regarding Walker was from Walker's chief of staff, Scott Kendall, asking if Walker could run as a Republican. Babcock says the party told him it was a free country, but predicted the reception would not be warm. Walker was a Republican until he ran in 2014 as an independent, and says he wants to remain an independent.
For me, it's not a matter of hanging on at any cost, hanging on for another 4 years at any cost. I still got to be the same person walking out that walked in, and I'm not going to become somebody else to do that. I'm just not.
Walker's administration was shaken Tuesday when former Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott resigned. Walker has said Mallott made an inappropriate overture to an unnamed female victim. Walker says he made a commitment to the victim to only disclose information he had discussed with her. He says that saying more would violate her rights.
You know, what kind of a message did that send? You know, that it's more important for us to get it out for our benefit, for, you know, campaign purposes, and at that victim's expense. What's going to be the message of other victims that won't come forward and said, you know, they felt something was inappropriate? We want them to come forward. You know, we want them to. So we aren't going to be the ones that are going to walk away from that commitment. I'm just not going to do it.
The governor's wife, Donna Walker, stepped in to say Mallott did the right thing by resigning.
He paid the price. You can't really get much more of a price out of a situation like this. Stepped down from second highest job in the state, and he and his family are suffering. This is a man who's, you know, an outstanding career, so many accomplishments. The family's in grief, and we're in grief with them.
Donna Walker says speculation online about Mallott is far from the truth. With help from Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, in Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
The first day of the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention kicked off in Anchorage today, featuring protests and a high-level apology. Alaska Public Media's Abby Collins has more.
Valerie Nararalek Davidson was already set to be the keynote speaker, but the speech took on even more importance after the surprise announcement Tuesday that she'd been sworn in as lieutenant governor, amid Byron Malott's sudden resignation over, quote, inappropriate comments, something Davidson referred to in her speech.
So let's acknowledge where we are. Just 2 days ago, our world shifted, and I want you to know that Alaskans deserve the highest standard of conduct by their elected officials. Respect for women and the dignity of all Alaskans is our responsibility.
The address was broad and personal, touching on the administration's expansion of Medicaid, Davidson's own struggles with childhood trauma, and the importance of the tribal compact the state announced last year. Over and over again, Davidson said the current administration's policies have significantly elevated the role of Alaska Natives in guiding state policy.
We invited more people to the conversation and recognized that listening is more productive than litigation.
Soon after came an address by Walker himself. He, too, referred to the week's resignation, calling Malott a brother and soulmate who had taken responsibility for a mistake. Though Walker never overtly focused on the dynamics of his reelection campaign, which currently favor his Republican opponent, he did allude to it briefly.
You know, this may be the last time I address you formally. I recognize that.
With that, Walker primed the audience for a big announcement, and for a minute, it seemed like the room was holding its breath. But it wasn't a campaign revelation. Instead, it was a formal apology to Alaska Natives for the wrongs they have endured from the state.
As the 11th governor of the state of Alaska, I apologize to you, Alaska's First People, for the wrongs that you have endured for generations. For being forced into boarding schools, I apologize. For forced to abandon your native language and adopt a foreign one, I apologize. For erasing your history, I apologize. For the generational and historical trauma you have suffered, I apologize. This apology is long overdue. It is but one step in hundreds more to go on this journey towards truth, reconciliation, and healing.
Walker also thanked the Federation for embracing him during his term as governor. Two blocks away from the convention stage, demonstrators gathered for a rally focused on defending Indigenous women and protecting the environment. Quanta Chasing Horse Potts called for an end to violence.
For far too long, women, our Indigenous women, our lands and our waters have been traumatized and victimized.
The rally was organized by Defend the Sacred AK and brought together a patchwork of groups focused on wildlife conservation, subsistence rights, as well as domestic violence and sexual assault prevention. Well over 100 people gathered outside the Performing Arts Center in downtown Anchorage. AFN continues through Saturday, with remarks from gubernatorial candidates and Alaska's congressional delegation in the days ahead. With help from Zachariah Hughes and Andrew Kitchman, in Anchorage, I'm Abby Collins.
Please welcome to the stage the Honorable Tara Sweeney, Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs at the U.S. Department of Interior.
Tara Sweeney was welcomed back to the AFN convention with loud cheers and applause. Sweeney is a Inupiaq and a former co-chair of AFN. She is the first Alaska Native to hold the Assistant Secretary position, but she gave honors to the late Morris Thompson of Tanana. Thompson, in 1973, became the first Alaska Native to head the Bureau of Indian Affairs before the Assistant Secretary position was created. Sweeney says he paved the way.
So I share this stage with him and his family and his spirit.
Sweeney provided a progress report on issues of importance to Alaska Natives. She says the Interior Department is working on a new process for how Alaska tribes can apply to put their land into trust. Tribes can get Indian country jurisdiction over lands by putting them into trust. That allows them to avoid local taxes and impose their own, among other benefits. Sweeney says consultations on a new process are underway and the comment period ends in December. Sweeney also called for continued vigilance to fight drug use in Alaska Native communities.
Now, I'm fully aware that BIA does not provide law enforcement in Alaska, but I am committed to finding new ways for the BIA to be engaged in protecting our Alaska Native villages.
And she spoke about the Indian Child Welfare Act. That's a 1978 law aimed at ending the removal of Native American children from their communities. A federal judge in Texas recently concluded the law is unconstitutional. Sweeney assured the convention the government will fight that decision.
The Department of Interior strongly opposes any diminishment of ICWA's protection for Indian children, families, and tribes.
The Assistant Secretary for Land and Minerals Management, Joe Balash, also gave an address. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke taped a video that was played to the convention. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, amid flat funding from the legislature, the Anchorage School Board enters mediation for teacher contracts.
Well, you do that for two or three years in a row, it's really not flat funding because other costs still keep going up.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
A former head of two Alaska juvenile detention facilities has been charged with possession of child pornography. Federal prosecutors announced the charge Wednesday against 54-year-old Dennis Weston. Anchorage television station KTVA reports Weston is the former superintendent of McLaughlin Youth Center in Anchorage. He's also the former head of the Johnson Youth Center in Juneau. The indictment alleges that Weston possessed digital depictions of minors engaged in explicit sexual conduct. Weston was hired as a juvenile justice officer in 1992 and rose to be division operations manager. He was placed on administrative leave June 26th and resigned a month later. Weston's phone number was not immediately available, and his attorney is not listed in court online documents. Teachers in the Anchorage School District are working without a contract. That's how they began the school year, and 2 months of negotiations between the teachers' union and the district have failed. There's a wide gap between the salary increase teachers are asking for and the offer from the district. And as the parties enter mediation today, both sides say they're hoping to avoid a strike. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports.
Generally, Anchorage School District teacher contracts last for 3 years. But for the past 2 years, Anchorage teachers have had year-to-year contracts. For Tom Claymeyer, it feels like the negotiations have been never-ending. He's the head of the Alaska Education Association, the teachers' union.
Having started the subsequent school year with an expired contract, we've just been at this for so long that I think it's become difficult.
Currently, the AEA is requesting a salary increase of 9.5% over 3 years. The school district is offering 2.25% over 3 years. The dispute comes during the longest recession in state history. For the past 3 years, the BSA, or base student allocation, from the legislature has been flat. That's the money that the district receives per student from the state. The legislature did allocate a little over $10 million in their last budget, but ASD Chief Financial Officer Jim Anderson says it's not enough.
Well, you do that for two or three years in a row, it's really not flat funding because other costs still keep going up. Utilities goes up, rent goes up, contracts for copiers, paper, all those things keep increasing.
Anderson says teachers already receive raises every year, step increases, of about 2% based on experience and education level. Claymeyer says the union is frustrated that despite stagnant salaries for teachers, higher-level administrators in the school district received significant raises a year and a half ago.
From the time that the previous superintendent, when Ed Graff was there, and then when they hired Dr. Bishop, that increased, I'd have to look at the numbers again, but it was something like from $180,000 to $230,000. And then her next year, she got a 5% raise while everybody else is getting zeros.
Anderson, with the district, defended those raises, noting administrators are exempt from step increases, and that Superintendent Dina Bishop cut administrative positions in order to allow for that funding. Overall, it resulted in about $80,000 less in spending for the fiscal year. Anderson says giving teachers comparable raises isn't feasible.
Now, for us to do that for teachers, we have to lay off 600 or 800 of them. Well, that's not possible.
In their contract request, the AEA has also asked for more flexibility for teachers in their lesson plans. Claymire says the district implemented curriculum that limits the ways teachers can teach. Anderson says that's an unfair characterization. The mediation phase of the contract negotiation is the second step in a five-step negotiation process after the initial offer. If the mediation doesn't result in an agreement, the next phase would be bringing in an arbitrator to make an offer that both sides could agree to. If that doesn't work, the two parties are obligated to bargain one last time before teachers could strike. And that's something neither side wants. Jennifer Haldane works in human resources for the school district.
At this point, we are just working towards reaching an agreement. That's the stage of mind we're in at right now.
Mediation will go through October 19th. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
The Seward City Council will meet tomorrow to vote on a formal emergency declaration following several days of heavy rainfall and flooding. In the meantime, city and borough crews, along with local contractors, have been working overtime to give all of that rainwater somewhere to go. Kenai Peninsula Borough Emergency Manager Dan Nelson told the assembly during a special meeting Wednesday, the problem isn't too much water, it's all the debris the water washes toward Resurrection Bay.
In the Seward area, when we have these high-velocity floodwaters, when we have things coming down from the mountains, that is also carrying gravel and debris. So what that does in Seward is that tends to fill up that existing channel with debris, so we still have a water channel that has to move somewhere.
Excavators and other heavy equipment worked around stream beds to clear out accumulated debris and give the water a more clear path to the bay. The Borough Assembly approved releasing $500,000 in emergency funds to help protect its assets outside the city. In a memo to the borough, Seward's interim city manager Jeff Bridges said their declaration will remain open as the current weather system moves through. Crews have been at work since last Friday. Nearly 5 inches of rain have fallen since Monday, with more expected into the weekend. Heavy rains hit southeast Alaska too, triggering a large mudslide on the Haines Highway. As KHNS's Henry Leisha reports, the Alaska Earthquake Center says seismic activity may have also played a role.
State road crews spent most of Sunday clearing mud and debris along a four-mile stretch of Haines Highway that kept the road closed until early evening. Department of Transportation spokeswoman Ora Landau said the two main slides were in places crews are familiar with.
19 Mile and 23 Mile have a history of sliding. You know, there's maybe one, two, three, a couple times a year that the material comes down over the road.
She said the largest slide was roughly 100 feet long and up to 8 feet deep.
In this case, especially at the 23-mile slide, it was like soupy jello, and they were shoving off the road.
The cleanup is estimated to cost the state $200,000 to $400,000. When it comes to mudslides, wet weather is usually the culprit. 3 inches of rain were recorded by the National Weather Service at the U.S.-Canada border post 20 miles from the slide. Federal meteorologist Joel Curtis said the steep slopes above the Haines Highway can only absorb so much rainwater.
Once you start soaking them in real good and they become completely saturated, clearly that adds more weight to the system and also is some lubricant that allows it to move.
But there's evidence of another force at work. A 3.6 magnitude earthquake centered about 12 miles from the slides was recorded at 7:04 a.m. Sunday. The first report of the highway mudslide came just 25 minutes later. Seismologist Natalia Rupert at the UAF Alaska Earthquake Center reasoned the two could be linked. She told KHNS that the small quake likely provided that extra push that saw tons of mud, rock, and earth tumble down and blanket parts of the highway. So between the heavy rain, the steep terrain, and a small tumbler, Sunday saw the perfect storm for a slide on the Haines Highway. Alaska can't stop the rain, nor can it prevent earthquakes, but DOT says there are plans for engineers to improve the slide-prone stretch of road. In Haines, I'm Henry Leisha.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Raven Alaska. Raven serves Alaskans in over 115 communities across the state, from Valdez, Utqiagvik, and more. Information at flyraven.com.
A draft proposal outlines plans for the Fairbanks North Star Borough to become more sustainable by boosting food security, reducing energy consumption, and minimizing waste. The Fairbanks Daily News Miner reports the borough took public comment on the Sustainability Commission's plan through Wednesday. The plan includes goals of increasing local food production, promoting the use of solar panels, and diverting 25% of waste from the landfill by 2025. The plan does not detail how the goals will be met. The Sustainability Commission was created in 2017 to replace and broaden the Recycling Commission. Commission member Jimmy Fox says the community has a desire to be more conservative with our food, materials, and energy. The plan is expected to be finalized in January. The Alaska Board of Fisheries agenda was packed with hatchery issues Tuesday. Board members considered putting some issues on future agendas, but they also held a public forum on the broader state of hatcheries following a lengthy report from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. As KBBI's Aaron Bolton reports, some board members expressed interest in taking a wait-and-see approach when it comes to increasing hatchery production.
The board spent about 4 hours on hatcheries, beginning with a long report from Fish and Game Chief Fisheries Scientist Bill Templin. Templin addressed a plethora of hatchery issues, namely hatchery straying and ocean carrying capacity. The department is currently conducting an extensive study on hatchery strays in Prince William Sound in southeast Alaska, but when it comes to the volume of salmon the North Pacific Ocean can support, Templin explained that the scientific community is far from providing a comprehensive answer.
Because now we're not talking about just a larger area, but we're talking about the entire North Pacific. As has been mentioned, one of our Russian colleagues likens it to catching a moonbeam in a jar.
The department's Hatchery Wild Research Project is due to release the first round of several genetic reports in the coming months, which will inform the board's discussion on whether hatchery fish that spawn with wild stocks reduce their productivity. Templin also noted that some hatchery programs could be brought more closely in line with department policies. He gave a few recommendations for Prince William Sound programs, which have drawn an increasing amount of scrutiny after hatchery fish from the area were found in lower Cook Inlet streams.
Recommended actions that can be taken immediately include completing the identification of significant and unique stocks and wild stock sanctuaries, implementing an annual survey to index stray rates in wild streams, and completing the work that has already begun on population structure and productivity through the Alaska Hatchery Research Program.
Board members also held a public hatchery forum, which turned into an hour-long listening session filled with comments from hatchery supporters, critics, and those in between. However, board members reserved most of their comments for when the board considered two agenda change requests related to hatchery production. The first mirrors previous requests to prevent the Valdez Fisheries Development Association from increasing the egg take at its Solomon Gulch hatchery by 20 million. The board shot down that request. Board member Israel Payton didn't support the proposal, but he did question increases in production more broadly.
Looking at that graph, it looks like slowly over the years, the relationship of hatchery caught fish and wild stock fish and harvest rates is getting closer. They're both large, but when do we say that a hatchery fish, should we stop? Is it when we're catching 51% hatchery fish? So I think a lot of people are just concerned about that, you know, taking a breath and not introducing more.
Member Orville Huntington echoed Payton. According to Fish and Game staff, the total permitted egg take across the state has increased by nearly 1 billion eggs since 2000. And hatchery fish accounted for 21% of the total commercial catch in 2017. Those numbers were called into question by another request calling for the board to reduce the total statewide egg take to 1.2 billion. Chairman Reed Morisky spoke in favor of considering the proposal.
This ACR is not talking about eliminating hatcheries. It's talking about capping capacity. And as the department indicated, there's more science that needs to be done, and it's uncertain when or how that might occur, and I think we should take a pause.
Morisky and Huntington were the only board members to vote in favor of putting the proposal on a future agenda. The board's discussion on hatchery issues is set to continue in March, when the full board will meet as the hatchery committee for the first time. The board is set to focus on more regional hatchery issues in the coming years. I'm Aaron Bolton, reporting in Homer.
Running a small town can be tricky. Everyone knows everyone, and conflicts of interest easily arise as people move from public service to public employment, and back again sometimes. As KSTK's June Leffler reports, Wrangell's city manager's recent decision to hire a sitting assembly member raised eyebrows.
Roland Howe was recently tapped to be the director of public works. The job pays $80,000 a year and has good benefits. When Howe applied, he was an elected member of the assembly. What does that mean? Well, the city manager hires senior city employees, and she serves at the will of the assembly. Imagine being interviewed by one of your employees for a job where they'd be your boss. City manager Lisa Von Bargen understands the weird optics, but she checked with the city's attorney.
And there was nothing that precluded him as a seated assembly member at that time from applying.
Those in the know say this type of thing happens all the time.
When it comes especially to small communities across Alaska, we have community members who are wearing multiple hats.
Niels Andreasen is the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League, which advises local governments on sticky issues like these.
I think a good best practice is to be just upfront about what that conflict of interest is.
The matter didn't stick right with one assembly member. David Powell voted against the deal.
I consider Mr. Howell a friend, but this is not about him being a friend or him about getting this job. This is about our code.
So what does Wrangell's code say? An elected official can take a city job if he or she receives a waiver from the assembly and then resigns. That's what happened. The vote was 4-1 with only Powell against it. Local governments like Wrangell write their own rules. They can be just as strict or relaxed as they want. That's because Alaska is a home rule state where the state has little influence on how a city governs itself. In fact, until this year, Wrangell's rule was a lot stricter. Assembly member Julie Decker explains.
We've had multiple occasions where good assembly members had to step down from serving on the assembly because their grandson wanted to work at the movie theater, a part-time job, or their daughter wanted to be a lifeguard at the pool, where we can't even get enough lifeguards to apply.
But the city's policy against nepotism was loosened after a mayor's son-in-law brought up the issue. He had a job offer with Parks and Recreation that was retracted due to his relationship with the mayor. That's when the assembly changed some rules. Wrangell School District made a similar move this year, though with less public scrutiny. Georgiana Bueller served as the school board president. She left her seat to apply for and be hired as the district's business manager. The district says the hire didn't conflict with its own rules. And it seems the city's deal wasn't unusual in a town of plus 2,000 people. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm June Loeffler.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Zachariah Hughes, Abby Collins, and Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Henry Leisha in Haines, Aaron Bolton in Homer, and June Loeffler in Wrangell. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Happy Alaska Day.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
The Seward Peninsula Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will discuss proposals to change federal subsistence fish and shellfish regulations and other subsistence-related issues, and invites public participation at a meeting October 23rd and 24th starting at 9 a.m. at the Native Village of Unalakleet Community Building in Unalakleet. More at 800-478-1456 or doi.gov/subsistence/regions. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.